Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Anna Whateley. Anna has a PhD in literature from Queensland University. She's an author of young adult fiction that engages with diversity and the depth of human experience. Anna is joining me today to discuss her debut novel, Peter Lyre's Rating Normal. My name's Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Now, 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people, and I want to start by acknowledging the traditional owners, pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, and acknowledge that this is stolen land. Treaty was never reached in Australia. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is all about books, writing, and literary culture, and every week I just want to share these books with more and more people. And if you can help me do that, well, give this a rating in whatever podcast app you're listening to. Maybe leave a comment. I'd love to hear from you. And, you know, tell a friend, tell a book lover, tell someone in a bookshop about us. Anything to put new Australian books in front of more eyes would just make me so incredibly happy. Now, today on the show, Peter Lyre lives in a world that isn't made for her brain. She's got an alphabet to contend with and a list of rules about what to do and what to avoid. But she's also got her best friend Jeb and the school ski trip to look forward to. When a new girl starts at Peter's school, she suddenly finds herself with two best friends and a whole lot of confusion. Peter's always been told that she needs to follow the rules to be normal. But is normal really the best thing for her? Join me as we discover Anna Whateley's Peter Lyre's Rating Normal. This is Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and I have, well, if you don't know, Final Draft is books, writing, and literary culture. I have an absolutely terrific new Australian book to introduce to you. It is Anna Whateley's Peter Lyre's Rating Normal. Anna has a PhD in literature from Queensland University. She's an author of young adult fiction that engages with diversity and the depth of human experience. Her debut novel, as I've said, is Peter Lyre's Rating Normal, and she's joining me today via Zoom. Anna, welcome. Thanks so much for coming on Final Draft.
Oh, thanks for having me, Andrew. It's a pleasure.
Now, I loved Peter Lyre, and rather than introduce the story myself, I wanted to actually start with your acknowledgements for the book. You begin thanking Peter Lyre. Her voice hit you like a snowstorm when you thought the sky was empty. That is an extraordinary testimonial, and I'll back up that Peter is an incredible character. It's your job to introduce this incredible person. Could you start by telling us a little bit about how you found her voice and how her story emerged for you?
Now hearing that back, I haven't really thought about that since I wrote the acknowledgements. That was good I wrote that because it was that way. I really didn't know. I didn't know about voice. I didn't know about how you found your voice when you were writing. And writing Peter Lyre was a moment where I had a really tight deadline. I needed to submit a manuscript because I'd booked an editor assessment that I really wanted to submit for, and I didn't have a book. So I actually had to, I'd written something I knew was wrong, and I really needed to dig deep, and I knew then that I needed to find that thing that I was avoiding. I needed to go to the place I didn't want to go. And for me, that was those years when you're 16 and everything's quite painful. And I just started to write. I had Peter, I had thought, what if I write everything I think as I would, but with this other person? And so Peter just arrived, and I sat her on that bench with Jeb, and they just started up together, and everything just flowed from there, and it was written quite quickly. And it just came out as you see it, basically. It really just arrived in that way, and there wasn't a lot of sort of planned, or things were, I would be sort of, all of a sudden I'd think, right, she has to be studying a book, this has got to have something else in it, what are we doing? Right, I love Frankenstein, that fits, excellent. Next thing you know, that was in there all the way through. So it wasn't sort of a laborious process, it was very much spontaneous.
That initial conversation is so natural. It's so two teenagers just sitting together chatting. But it's also not, because they're discussing Peter's alphabet. Peter has a range of, I guess, what we would sort of have in the common parlance diagnoses that give her an alphabet, and Peter's thinking about how there's really not many great words she can make out of it. What did you want to do there, both normalizing but also exceptionalizing who Peter is?
Well, when I started writing, the question I had in my mind was, what happens if you get everything right? What if you have all these diagnoses, you acknowledge them, you're open about those with the close people in your life, and you're diagnosed, you've had all your therapies. What if you do everything they ask you to do? What if you actually have achieved the point where you remember all the rules that they've taught you and you can perform that for people? What would happen? And so part of writing the first pages was getting out that this is where we're at right now. This is where she is right now. This is who she is. And this is where we're starting from. And then what will happen? So that was definitely, I wanted it to be overt. I wanted to not shy away from the labels. And having it written in own voice allows me to do that more easily, perhaps. I don't have to worry whether or not I fit her to them. I think when people aren't writing in own voice, they worry that if they say their character is autistic and then they don't, their character does something that's not going to fit with that diagnosis, people will get upset with them. And, I think that can be quite fraught. But for me, I could just, be overt with that, not be, there's so much out there where people are guessing, ooh, I think that character has ADHD, or I think that character's autistic. Well, I didn't want everyone to be guessing. I didn't want it to be it's not a detective process. This is who she is. Now where are we going to go from there? Because she is exceptional, and it is in that it is unusual. It's not typical, and that's the reason for the diagnosis. That's where I started from.
Let's go then to, I guess, where Peter takes off from that point where things are acknowledged, she has people that she trusts, and she's a very sort of focused person in her life, and you realise that focus and attention through these interior or internal dialogues that are signalled by the italics in the book, but it's very seems to be what Peter is thinking and how she's internally responding. They seem to be this melange of, I guess, a heightened focus that she has, but also, I'm going to say, cautionary lessons from therapists where she'll say, don't do this, or you must try to do this. It struck me that in trying to be normal, and I'm going to use the scare quotes there, Peter's had something of that variety of people's behavior flattened out for her. Normal becomes a rating system for her out of 10 that she'll give herself at the end of a day or after an event. But Peter, she's so often very harsh on herself. What did you want that system to say about Peter and to say about the way she moves in the world?
She uses the rating system and the internal monologue of the rules that she's gotten from different therapists, teachers, parents, books. It wasn't, we didn't, it's not just the one thing. And the rating system wasn't, again, it wasn't intentional. I was at the end of the first chapter and I thought, how am I going to explain to people what that process is like when you walk away from an interaction and you are thinking to yourself, did I pass? Did I successfully perform being a human? Did I do everything I was told I had to do to be recognisable to my peers? And so then that's where she rates herself out of 10. But it also then allowed me, as the book went on, to for her to process that and to abandon that because it's destructive. The whole process is so destructive, and yet we still do it to ourselves all the time. I do it to myself all the time. You come away from school pickup or wherever it is you've been, even at the checkout, and you'll think, oh, I didn't quite pass there. Or you celebrate that you passed as a really normal person. And that is just as destructive because then you're rewarding yourself for not being your more authentic self.
Now, one of the reasons I loved reading Peter Lyre's Rating Normal is the way you open up and make so incredibly empathetic Peter's life, the life of her friends, in a way that I think any reader can come to it. But when I looked at that rating system and I looked at the way you move through it and you start to slowly abandon it, I thought, wow, Peter is doing something that I do that I'm sure most everyone does, but she has made it so formal. You know, Peter's giving herself a 2 out of 10 is just this really numerical structured version of that hot flush. Your ears are burning. You suddenly can't make eye contact with people. But I guess part of being neurotypical is that you have the luxury of having that reaction, processing it and putting it away, which I guess Peter doesn't have, at least initially.
Yeah, and not having it as often, I think. I think we associate that moment for neurotypical people, going by from what I know, is definitely put down to that, oops, that was that moment that you're then going to talk about later when you're an adult. Oh, I remember when I, you know, grabbed the wrong person in the crowd. It wasn't my mum, it was someone else. Or, and you get that moment of, oh, no, I've just totally embarrassed myself, or in one way or another. Whereas when you're neurodivergent, those moments are constant and never ending and on so many levels. And so that the fatigue of that, I think, comes through.
And one of the things that Peter has, and I guess she tries to indulge in the luxury of, his friendship. She marvels at one point that she has two amazing close friends, and she can't believe that she's suddenly got two best friends. And friendship seems to be at the heart of Peter's story. Now, as Peter waits for Jeb one afternoon, she pours over the words of Mary Shelley's monster from Frankenstein. It is true we shall be monsters cut off from all the world, but on that account we shall be more attached to one another. Now, that quote, for me, it felt like it contained in it the desperation with which Peter holds on to her friends, but it also kind of hints for me at the irony of considering the monster in the book a monster and not the world, in fact, that is rejecting the monster. And that got me thinking a lot about Peter and, you know, so many of the children out there like Peter. Do you feel like the world has any hint or understanding or sympathy around what neurodiversity is and means? Or is that something we're still really grappling with?
Definitely grappling with. And I think that hearing it back there, it just sort of strikes me that she was thinking that they are like her. It's okay. She's okay because they're all still birding. They're trying to figure it out. And often people will read Peter Lyre and say, but I get it a bit, that, oh, aren't all teenagers a bit like that? Don't we all go through some things like that? Because they may identify with aspects of the novel. And I think anyone who's had an anxious moment will identify with aspects of the novel. It doesn't mean that they're autistic or have ADHD. But again, it's that consistency of experience that's different. And the idea that aren't we all a bit this, or aren't we all a little bit autistic, or I'm a bit ADHD, is actually really unhelpful, because it's watering down our experience of life. It's watering down our struggles, and it's the trap that Peter falls into, where she thinks we're all monsters together. We're all doing this the same. You all understand what I'm going through because we're going through the same thing. But then she realizes, no, they're not, that they aren't going through what she's going through. And no matter how much they love her and she loves them, they are looking through different lenses at the world, and they have different confusions and different complications and their own stories. So the thing with the monsters being in it together, I think it's, and again, there must be experiences for neurotypical people where you'll think, oh, we're all going to dance this way and this is the cool way to dance. And you think, yeah, we're all going to do this together, and then it turns out they were joking and mucking around and you were doing it seriously. And then you all of a sudden think, uh-oh, I misunderstood that moment. I better pretend quickly that I was joking too. Yeah, I didn't really mean to dance like a chicken or whatever it was. So yeah, I think there are moments like that, but yeah.
Yeah, just throwing it out there. Make sure that it's definitely a toga party before you turn up in a toga. That's all I'm going to say about this.
It's kind of what I was thinking about, yeah.
Yeah, no, that never happened to me. It's actually turned out quite well. Is that a trap then? I guess for neurotypical people, a trap of understanding and empathy, where what you described there is that people are trying to use this reaching out for some sort of commonality of experience, but using it almost in a dismissive way. Oh, we're all a little bit like that, so therefore you're more normal and I don't have to pay attention to you because you're just going through a thing like I'm going through.
Yeah, and we don't need to provide you any extra help or assistance. And so that's when it's dangerous. It's great to be accepting in your everyday life and to think, to not, so when you see difference, if you accept you have to accept the difference in others and you have to face any strangeness. And I didn't make that up. I think that came from Kristeva. But that you, when you see something that gives you that reaction of, oh, that's different, You have to accept the difference in others, but you must face the strangeness. Why do you find it strange that someone did that? Why did you find their hands flapping strange? And if you, the more you understand what they're doing, then it will become a difference and not so much a strangeness, because then that's probably a little bit off topic. But yeah, providing assistance is what we were saying. If you try to normalize the neurodivergence, then you're undermining the help that's required and that we know is needed.
Was there something in that of the way you portray Peter's medication and the way she uses medication in the book, where she's very open with her friends and she's very explicit, particularly in her internal dialogues, about what she needs and how this works, and even moments where she thinks, I wish I could take more because it gives me the calmness or the sense of security that I need, but also understanding that that's not perhaps something that she can do.
Yeah, and the medication is you're constantly aware of it. It's never, you can never be, you can never forget, because especially if you take it three times a day, as I do, you must, and of course the irony of taking a medication three times a day when you have issues with organisation and concentration is a little bit, and that's a bit obvious, isn't it, that that'll be there. But I wanted the medication to be in there because we never see it, and I wanted it to be, it's based on a personal experience. I knew I would be able to get that right and how that feels, but also that it's not just a cure-all, that it's not a magic pill, it doesn't take away the ADHD, and also that there are side effects, there's a downside, and that taking it isn't an easy decision. And that for some people it doesn't actually even work properly. But for others it may work, but then it causes its own issues. But it's still better than not having it. And so I wanted all that complication to be played out. And also, especially if you're kept awake all night for some reason, what happens? Like, you're stuck. I've been in a hospital where I woke up from an operation at midnight, and you don't have Ritalin at midnight, and they give you a red button and say, press it if there's anything you need. So I'm sitting there with my impulse control issues and a red button and no medication. Press, 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 press. It's basically, and she's in that situation because you're thinking, no, you don't understand they don't understand what I'm going through. Anyway, I thought I'd put that all in there as well.
I talked a little bit about friendship and the importance of that to the book, and a new student arrives at Peter's school and instantly drawn into the group with Peter and Jeb, and there's a snow trip that, you know, features prominently both on the gorgeous cover and within the narrative. But I actually want to think a little bit about romance. Now, I watched one of your YouTube videos where you discussed readers' responses to Peter and Sam's relationship. I personally think you crafted this beautiful and patient story between them. But what I really wondered about, you discussed in the video about how people had these kind of different responses, wanting more, wanting something that you didn't provide, which, I mean, I guess that's that's a part of reading. We all go, oh my God, why didn't the author just do this with the character? Yep. But I wondered though, do you think that readers also project certain expectations on the relationship for the sake of neurodiverse representation? Was there more at stake because they wanted to see a particular type of relationship for Peter?
I think people wanted it to fit just neatly enough into a neurotypical expectation. I think they didn't want her or her relationship to be different in a way that would leave them feeling unsatisfied. I think, and a reader has an expectation to be satisfied by a novel, whether it's good, bad, you know, happy or sad or whatever, you should be satisfied that it's met the expectations of the arc for the relationship and for the narrative. And I think they were perhaps, because of the stories we've been given for so long, perhaps wanted Sam to save Peter, which I really clearly didn't want, because I think it's a really unsafe. I think that would be a really unsafe thing to happen, because then if anything goes wrong, Peter's left again with nothing to rely on. She needed to save herself in the end. But Sam wasn't written in as the main point of the novel. If anything, Jeb's a bigger relationship for Peter. She knows Jeb. She's known him for years. They're very close. She sees him clearly. And it's very much, and when you have issues with too many people in the world, it's very difficult to see everyone and all of their needs all at once, because you can't ignore them. So when you let someone into your world, as an autistic person, when you let someone into your world, you're letting in all of their needs and all of their pain, as well as all the good things. And that's a big risk. It's a lot to take on. So when she starts her relationship with Sam, it's very much a sensual thing. It's very much an attraction thing, but she's not yet, and for quite a lot of the novel, Sam's not quite yet let in as that fully rounded person, because that would be just too much to take in. There's so much else going on for Peter. And that's actually just the realistic experience of life for me. And yet I didn't even realise I'd written that in until later. It was only looking back I realised what I'd done there. And unpacking their relationship at the end did take a lot of assistance from my editor, because, and I don't know if this happens, I expect this happens with neurotypical people. Sometimes you have a fight with someone or you break up with someone. You don't know what happened. You just couldn't move on. You don't actually always know. And for me as a reader, I always thought I was expected to put some of that work in. And I suppose I expect my readers to put some of that work in as well to figure that out. And that Peter is 16 years old. She might be unlikely to know the depths of what's happened to her at the time. But we did put enough in, I believe, to have unpacked, to work that through, even though I personally would have wanted to completely back away and not do any of that, because it's really uncomfortable. But it was worth facing some of that to put it in there, and it's definitely good. But I think neurotypical readers in particular have some of them been left wanting more of the romance, and all the way through. But for me, it's Peter's story, and I don't have any of those comments from my neurodivergent community. So I just thought that was interesting. It's hard for me to understand as a neurodivergent person, you know, what was going on there.
As you spoke there, I was just having the most interesting thoughts when you talked about what neurotypical people might have expected and that particular way of reading, and it just kept coming into my head. That's genre. That's how we use genre when we read, not as crafters of narratives, but as readers of narratives. We say genre tells us, in a story where we have a female protagonist who has a male friend, he's the sidekick, he is the bit player, and the person who comes into their life is the love interest, and that story has to play out a certain way. That's genre when it's written in a book, and that's just, I guess, neurotypical living when it's lived experience. And that is incredible then to look at how, I mean, from a reader's perspective, you can break genre expectations and create perhaps, for me, I say, a more satisfying narrative, but satisfying in the sense that it may not necessarily satisfy those expectations.
Well, yeah, you've got to push the envelope a little bit. I think if we just tick all the boxes all the time, then it's much more formula fiction. And I wouldn't consider myself to be, while I think you do obviously have to have some, you have to have the basic elements there. I don't want to be a formula writer. I don't, you know, I want, and I, you can break some of those rules. You can bend them. You can kind of mold them a little bit. And I did my best to push those limits in Peter Lyre in terms of form and function as well as the content by using, obviously there's the italics and there's some of those things there. But I think readers can be, if you kind of hold their hand a little bit through that and you keep them going, and if it's fast enough and the book is quite a quick pace in that way, then you're not left sort of, you know, it's not a, you're not left, I can't think of the word, you're not likely to not finish reading. If something gets too difficult and is completely unfamiliar in a way that doesn't feel right, but you're actually just lost, well, then you're not likely to keep even reading. So you can't do that to a reader. But I think if it's got enough else going to keep you pulling through, then you may actually find that those differences and the bits where it's varying from what you would expect, they might actually be the thing that you think back on more once you've finished.
As just a complete aside too, I fell in love with Jeb. He is just the way he had this softness to him and this understanding. I've forgotten the specific term that Peter uses for sort of the sensory cuddles that she needs occasionally, but he's giving her the deep pressure. But she has a term that she uses that was introduced to her as a child by one of her therapists, I think. I just momentarily forgot this. We're not going to interrupt the interview to find the specific term, but he's giving her one of these cuddles at the snow, and but also kind of talking sort of semi out loud to about it being cold to help people understand I guess a neurotypical understanding of what's happening, to take that attention away from Peter, and just the way he had that sensitivity to respond and react. I just fell in love with him. Like, we don't often get those beautiful portrayals of masculinity that don't need to put themselves center stage but are actually able to just be.
Yeah, and I wanted him to be so supportive of her. So Jeb, I needed Jeb to be the friend that we want. I needed him to get it, to do the things that you would do for someone you love, but not be patronizing and not be, aren't I good? Aren't I a good person for pitying my friend who needs this right now? I didn't want there to be any sense of pity or shame or, you know, that there's, I mean, I see it a lot in the schools that there's this view of, I'm going to be a good person because I have decided to tolerate this disabled friend of mine and that makes me good. Whereas Jeb's not thinking in terms of, I'll do this because it makes me good. He's just doing it because it's what she needs, and they love each other in that friendship way. And just as Peter does for him at other times in the novel, she does what he needs because she loves him, you know, as a friend. And so they have that. I needed it to be both ways. He gains a lot from their friendship just as she does. I wanted it to be the equal footing. And I needed him to provide that narrative of masculinity, because obviously with Sam and Peter, I didn't want there then to be a denial of the masculine in the novel. I just needed the balance myself, and I needed a good male character because a lot of the others aren't so great. And he allowed me to explore a lot of what I saw when I was growing up and what I still see now of the men and boys in my life who don't fit that hegemonic masculinity. They're not wanting to be that kind of guy, and they just he needs to work through that process in a way that's safe for him to vary that norm. So that's where he came from, really.
Yeah, I mean, you are so right, we need that. I mean, In some ways, I think what you just described there, that non-hegemonic masculinity, that softness, that ability to just be without having to be at the center, there's probably as much need for representation of that as so many other things in literature. Can I go to sort of a counterpoint to that? Because through flashbacks, you open up to us Peter's youth. We have a beautiful first meeting between Peter and Jeb. People can go and read that and discover it, because I wanted to look at those experiences she has with therapy. You explore how therapy can be helpful. It can offer strategies and techniques that are helpful, but that it also needs empathy. Peter needs support, but she also needs to be acknowledged as a person, and particularly not spoken to like a child. The way people speak to her and the way they kind of do this performance of sympathy with their voice is particularly galling, and I was interested in that.
Oh, the leaning in, and the it's that patronizing. Again, it's the pat on the head, and it's this idea of, because you are autistic or you have ADHD, people need to speak in this way to you. They need to hold you on the shoulder and look you dead in the eye and speak down to you, down. And I see it all the time, and all I can think is, you've just done the exact opposite of what would actually be a good idea right now. And the focus on people that, you know, that they must make eye contact, and that whether you're giving eye contact or not is whether or not you're paying attention. Well, if I have to give eye contact, it's much easier on a screen, but if you have to give eye contact, well, now everything else has gone out of my head, because I'm so busy trying to do this while studying your face that whatever, you know, that's actually the opposite of me paying attention to your words. And so people speaking down, not understanding that her ability to communicate herself to them isn't the same thing as her ability to understand what they're saying and what they're doing. So she's actually very, very smart. She's not mature ahead of her time, of course. That might be delayed. But that doesn't mean that they need to. It's horrible. I see it all the time. So if you know, to say an 8-year-old being spoken to like they're 5, and judging someone on their output. So I have a 12-year-old whose word ability is in sort of the top 1%, but doesn't write them because they're hard to spell. And so often his academic ability is judged on that output, on his ability to write. And then I think, if you got him to speak, and if you, then you would hear what he's capable of. And a lot of people have that, that difficulty. But yeah, people leaning in and talking down to her and not really understanding that just because someone has a disability doesn't mean that their schoolwork and their academic ability should be underestimated. And the low expectations causes a lot of problem. Hope I didn't go too off topic there, sorry.
Not at all. In fact, I wanna continue with this, because I thought it'd be really nice to wrap us around to thinking about Peter's intelligence and also that word ability. Because it's just something that I love. There's a particular moment where you were right in my zone, taking a deep dive into words. And in fact, as I wrote my introduction, I was taken back to Peter talking about her love of language. She's a person who notices things and how wonderful that can be, so wonderful, which, you know, is literally meaning full of wonder. But it also gets a bit stressful for her. And I was thinking about using the word incredible, which is literally not credible, although that's not what we use it for. And I called her extraordinary, which is beyond the ordinary, which I meant in a positive way, but I guess could literally not be positive. And how Peter might overthink those things, but also find that incredible joy in the way those words work. I love that, because that's what I find myself doing, and it's just a nice thing. And I think a lot of people who listen to this show probably love words in the same way, and I loved that about Peter.
I love words, and we actually had to take a lot out, I have to confess. It was one thing I indulged a little bit in the novel, and I had a lot more in terms of the words and the love of words and the repetition of them, that perseverance of repeating words and phrases over and over again. And perseverance is a is a big issue of mine. And it, but there's so much joy there in language. Obviously, I've studied language a lot as well, and I have a deep love of words and how everything works. Some of it comes from the fact that we get so much wrong. So especially with sayings that make no sense. So if you hear, you know, it's raining cats and dogs, and, you know, we're looking out the window wondering where all the cats and dogs are, but then you might try and find out where the saying came from. And, you know, and in our house we do a lot of unpacking of those little things, those sorts of ways that we say things. And through that we just continue to develop an understanding of language. And so there's a lot of representations of older autistic people who have no idea about that kind of thing, which I don't know is always accurate. Most autistic people I know have an over understanding, have a very deep understanding of language and how it works. And while we still find that we want to pay attention more closely to those sorts of figures of speech, we know what that means. Our reaction just might be a little odd, but we have been taught that. It just was taught differently, or we've understood it differently. And we love it. We go into any kind of word joke, especially puns. Puns are just, we love them. It's completely our sense of humour in our house. Words are amazing. Sorry, as I said, I can go on forever, which is why we had to edit a lot out, because my editor thought the point had been made I kept going.
If you'd like to discover more of this love of words, this love of life, this incredible person that is Peter Liar, she is so much a real person through the reading of this book. The book is Peter Liar's Rating Normal. It is from Anna Whateley. Anna's been having this conversation with me. Anna, look, thank you so much for joining me on Final Draft. I can't wait for more people to discover Peter.
Oh, thank you. I feel like we could talk for hours. I'm so pleased you read it and understood it so deeply. It means a lot.
That's it for this great conversation with Anna Whateley. Anna's debut novel is Peter Liar's Rating Normal, and it's out now through Allen & Unwin. Great Conversations is recorded on the lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And the show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. To keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We are at the tag at Final Draft 2SER. If you click subscribe in your podcast app, you have a new great conversation to look forward to every week. I am Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.